Let's talk. John Brown. The longest walk home, the epic 2,000-mile escape of a Second World War POW, in his own words. In 1914, Private Raymond Bailey, a 21-year-old Vauxhall motors apprentice, was captured in northern France, becoming a Nazi prisoner of war. But he wouldn't remain one for long. It is the epic tale, and I mean epic with a huge E. It was told by Ray Bailey. It was put together, compiled by David Wilkins. I'm delighted to say that David joins me, he's not moving by night through northern, heading through across the Pyrenees, thank goodness. He is somewhere nice and safe and warm. David, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Whereabouts do we find you, by the way? Not in a farmhouse somewhere near the Pyrenees, presumably.
No, I'm on the Isle of Portland, just off the south coast of England.
Very nice indeed. Tell me a little bit about yourself then, and how this fascinating story sort of crossed your radar.
Okay, well, I've bought for many years, decades actually, I've bought collections of old letters and papers and so on at auction. And when I retired, I decided to use some of these diaries and things that I'd bought to turn into books. I've become a writer, I suppose, in retirement. So the Ray Bailey book is my second. So back in 2018, I bought at an online auction a box full of notebooks, which were said by the seller to tell the story of a British soldier. And it was all very vague, but I like to gamble on these things. And when I got the box, I couldn't believe about the material that I'd got. So the box had something like 20 notebooks in it. I got them out, assembled them, put them in order, and I realised there were this personal story of this young soldier who'd escaped from prison of war column and made it all the way home. It's extraordinary to find an untold Second World War story. And it's not just a diary. What happened was Ray Bailey, who you've mentioned, he wrote an 80,000-word account of his experiences when he got home. That's a novel. I mean, it's not a novel, it's a true story. But I mean, 80,000
words is
the length of a novel. So all I've done essentially is assemble Ray's story not changed the order of it at all, but I've done a little bit of editing to it. But although he was only 19, going on 20 when he wrote it, he's actually a very fine writer. I mean, he wasn't an educated young man. He'd left school at 14. And as you said in the intro there, he worked before he was called up as apprentice engineer at Vauxhall in Luton. But he managed to write this extremely vivid and eloquent account of his escape and his journey home. So that's what the book is. My contribution to the book has been to add contextual notes about Ray's, what I know of Ray's personal history, and also about what happened to him after his escape. And I've also added bits which just explain what was happening in the war in the background, because otherwise you can't follow Ray's story if you don't know that. So that's been my contribution to the book.
And again, this is the 80,000 words, I mean, I've been able to scribble now and again, but he's not doing this. He's not thinking, right, I'm going to publish this as a Hollywood blockbuster. This is purely for his own record, if you like. If we were looking at it now, for 21st century, we say this is a form of his therapy. But it really is a thing. He's putting this down for himself rather than anything else, perhaps.
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting question. And if people buy the book, they can make up their own mind. I personally think that he probably did want it to be published. The reason I think this is, I got this box full of material belonging to him, and among the notebooks in the box was what you would call the beginnings of a juvenile novel. It was a crime thriller. So this was about a 10 or 15,000 words, completely unfinished, but the beginning of a very quite dramatic story about a bank robbery in London and all sorts of spies and all sorts of stuff in it. So I actually think that he hoped to become a writer. I don't know that. Or at the very, very least, I think what we can say is that he enjoyed writing and got a lot of pleasure out of it. So when he got home, he realised he'd actually been the centre of his own story. So he wrote it. So it's not written as so much as a memoir, as a series of exciting experiences that he had. So it's, I mean, as I'm quite intimately connected with this thing now, I've read it dozens of times. So I personally think he did hope it would be published subsequently, but I can't know that for sure. But yeah, people could read it and make up their minds.
So presumably he's in the BEF, he's in the British Expeditionary Force?
He's in the British Expeditionary Force. He's called up in 1939 because he was among the first people to be called, the first men to be called up. Yeah, he may or may not know, but because we were anticipating war with Germany, Britain had passed legislation earlier in the summer of 1939 so that they all were ready to go, immediately calling up 19 and 20-year-olds should there be a war. And, of course, there was a war. So Ray just happened to be in that age group. So, yes, he was called up immediately and he was sent. He had very little training, like lots of these young men. He was sent to France with his regiment a few months after he'd been called up. So he had about 6 months of training, and then he had 5 weeks in France before he was captured.
And whereabouts was he captured? And does he detail that in the letters?
Captured at the Battle of Saint-Valery in France.
Yeah,
which was, again, military historians who are listening will know more about this, but the Battle of Saint-Valery has actually in many ways been quite forgotten. But it was when the evacuations were happening from Dunkirk, there were thousands and thousands of British soldiers still caught on the northern coast of France who were not near enough to Dunkirk to get there, or who'd been further inland when Dunkirk was happening. That's what happened to the division that Ray was on. So his unit ended up with 10,000 British soldiers and 10,000 French soldiers trapped, again, with their backs to the sea in a tiny town in northwest France near the Belgian border, Saint-Valery. And they were, there were cliffs all around the town. I'm hoping to go there one day. I've never been.
Right.
The town's surrounded by cliffs. And the Germans were, there were large numbers of Germans on the cliffs, also bombing the town. There was no hope of them being evacuated. The way the conditions were, the way the harbour was at Saint-Valery, they couldn't get boats in. So they essentially had, there was nothing they could do, but the commanders had to surrender. So 20,000 soldiers, British and French, were captured in one go on that day.
That's a significant that's a significant number going in the bag. So what? Where is he taken to then? What is, you know, is he?
Well, okay. So what happens is they captured so many. The Germans captured so many soldiers in northern France. They had no plans initially for what to do with them. They had no infrastructure at all. So they just had a vague plan that they would march all these tens of thousands of people. So obviously not just those at Saint-Valery, but many had been captured elsewhere, to Germany and ultimately to Poland, which Germany just obviously occupied, where they were planning to build POW camps. So Ray's group was just formed into a long column, which different eyewitness accounts say different lengths for the column, but possibly a mile long, possibly as long as 4 miles,
wow,
this column.
Yeah.
And they were being marched towards the German border. There were guards stationed all the way alongside the column and motorbikes going up and down alongside. And as they neared the Belgian border, Ray just decided to take a chance. So he just slipped off the side of the column, jumped a hedge, landed in a cornfield, and lay there until the entire column had been marched by. His book is this. People might find this hard to believe, but his book is a series of anecdotes, and it's got a number of quite comical episodes in it amongst all this mayhem and carnage. And actually what happened was he got over this hedge, lay there hardly daring to breathe. He had to wait a long time for the column to pass by. But the guards at the back of the column happened to fall into conversation with some French girls who were out for a walk just exactly but where Ray was lying in the hedgerow. And the German guards were chatting up these girls by the sound of the story, and Ray had to just lie there in the hedge behind them, waiting for the Germans to feel the time had come to go and catch up with the end of the column. So that's what happened to him. So his story's extraordinary. He, as soon as the guards and the young women disappeared, he headed off some nearby woods, and within a very short time, he bumped into a French soldier who had done exactly the same thing. So initially, there were two of them looking after each other. So that's how his story began.
So you're 19 years old. You've thanked your lucky stars that the Germans and the French girls didn't go off and have an entente cordial over the hedge, because that would have been the end of the story, full stop. And but you've come out. I mean, and with the greatest of respect to the fine city of Luton, there is, you know, it's perhaps you haven't travelled very far out of Luton, because people didn't go away in those days, did they? Of course. So he's in a field, or he's in a wood, yes, with a French soldier. Presumably his French is non-existent, to say the least.
Non-existent. Yeah.
And it's like, okay, great, you got away from that. Well done. Now what?
Well, no, everything you say is completely true, and that's the, in a way, that bit of the story that touches your heart when you read it, because he's a very inexperienced lad. As you say, he's a working class lad. He left school at 14, and he speaks no French. He's never been abroad till he's put on this troop ship to Calais. So he has absolutely no idea what he's doing. The French lad who he bumps into, who's his own age, he yep. can't speak any English, Andre, he's called. So the two of them just walk along with each other, obviously relying on Andre to try and sort things out for any problems. But just parking that for a moment, what happens with Ray is he's just a kid. You know, if you've been a father of teenagers, as I have, and if you've been a teenager yourself and you think back to what you were like, obviously you do lots of daft things. You don't know really enough about the world to get on and make your own way, particularly in a foreign country when there's a war going on and you could get shot if you were caught. So he just manages by sheer chutzpah, really, to survive, and he has to improvise all the time. Much of the time, he doesn't know what he's doing. He makes rash decisions when at times, but he just has a lot of luck. And he's very well. What he's got is he's got the confidence of youth. It's like when you see some 18-year-old pick for England or Liverpool or something, and they come out on the pitch the first time. They play because they like they're playing in the park at home. And that's essentially the type of attitude that Ray has during his escape, and that's how he manages to get back in the end.
Does he have a compass? You know, does...
He doesn't. He doesn't have a map. He initially just went after he and Andre are first captured. Andre, because he speaks French, obviously, he manages to fall into conversation with a family, a woman, a mother of a family who live in a village near where they were, where they escaped. And they're taken in for about 6 weeks by this French family who care for them.
Right.
Then they set off on the rest of their journey. They separate because Andre wants to get back to his own family, who live near Cherbourg. And Ray just, there's more to it than this, but essentially he just starts walking south.
Is he hooking up with like the Comet line, or is that even in existence at this point?
That's very knowledgeable. He uses what ultimately will become part of the Comet line to cross the Pyrenees. However, this predates the Comet line. So the men who were, I'm cutting a very long story short. Yeah. He eventually ends up in an internment camp in Marseille because the French authorities are under a duty under the armistice in unoccupied France, this is in Vichy France.
Yeah.
They are under a duty by virtue of the armistice with Germany, up their bit of France,
yeah,
to not allow foreigners to leave the country. So Ray and about 30 other soldiers who've made a similar kind of journey as him end up in an internment camp in Marseille.
And this is Vichy France? This is Vichy France, I'm presuming.
This is in Vichy France.
Right, yeah, okay, yeah.
So So Vichy France isn't safe.
No.
He thinks it will be, but of course it isn't. There are lots of German troops in Vichy France. The French police are duty-bound to detain particularly British soldiers, all sorts of other people as well, of course. And Marseille is this melting pot of people of all nationalities all over the world. You know, people have escaped Germany and Eastern Europe and made it to Marseille. It's a port city they're trying to get out. The lads who are in internment in Marseille they're essentially on parole. They're allowed to leave the citadel where they're being held in the evenings. That's all. And during the
evening, they're allowed to wander around Marseille.
They are allowed to wander around. Yes. Yeah,
so, what could possibly go wrong?
Exactly. So what happens is they all try and plot escapes. Now, if you know a little bit about the Comet Line, you will know that a key figure in that was a church minister who's called Reverend Donald Caskey, who had been the Church of Scotland minister in Paris when Paris fell, and he had escaped and made his way, ended up in Marseille, and he had taken over as a job the management of the Siemens mission in Marseille, he allowed the mission to be used as a place for the lads in the evening to come in for a cup of tea and a chat, and he tacitly allowed them. Obviously, this is where they began to plan their escapes. Now, eventually, I'll explain very, very briefly what the Comet Line is, which you just mentioned. So the Comet Line was an escape line across the Pyrenees, largely aimed at helping airmen who'd been shot down. And it was set up during the war by British intelligence with the help of local guides. Reverend Donald Caskey was an important figure in feeding people to the Comet Line. He himself was eventually arrested and expelled from occupied France. He ended the war in Switzerland. But he was part of the foundation of the Comet Line, but the Comet Line did not exist. So Ray, a travelling companion he'd picked up by then called Jock, who's Scottish, obviously.
Right.
So they met in Marseille. Ray had been on his own until Marseille. They met in Marseille and crossed the Pyrenees together. They then obviously ended up in Spain. They separated again because they had a bit of a dispute about what the best way to travel through Spain was. Ray made it to Madrid and the British Embassy in Madrid and was eventually repatriated via Gibraltar.
But, you see, the thing is, Spain is quote-unquote neutral. And it's always quite funny because people go, oh, yeah, they crossed the Pyrenees. And if you've not been to the Pyrenees, you don't know what a huge mountain range. It's not like having a ramble across the South Downs, is it? I mean, it's this absolutely stupendous mountain range, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly right. I mean, Ray and Jock were slightly luckier than some in a way because Jock had, as before he was called up, had been a keen climber in the Highlands. However, Spain was neutral. You're absolutely right to say that. However, Spain was not remotely safe for British soldiers.
Crawling with British German agents.
Because Franco... Spain toyed with joining the Axis powers in the war. And although you could argue about whether Franco was a fascist or not, but he was certainly a proto-fascist. And so they were very much on the side of Germany. The Spanish Civil War had just ended. Spain had concentration camps all over, which were there for captured Republican prisoners. And what they began to do, as a very small number of British arrived at this early stage in the war, but those which were spotted by the Spanish police were thrown into concentration camps where the British authorities had to negotiate for their release. Some British soldiers allowed themselves to be captured because they figured spelling the concentration camp clearly, it's not going to be very nice, but they because there were agreements between Spain and Britain, they could be repatriated. Ray didn't want to do that. He didn't want to be captured. His travelling companion, Jock, did, which is the way he got home.
Yeah.
But Ray just simply walked alone from just north of Barcelona all the way. He walked to Barcelona, and then the British consulate in Barcelona put him on the train to Madrid. He, when he was in Madrid, this there's an interesting part of the story. People who live in Europe, maybe, he made it to the embassy, and when he got there, there were about five other British soldiers there, but they could not leave the embassy because they had diplomatic protection in the embassy. The lads who had been captured and placed in concentration camps were repatriated by negotiation, so they were then allowed onto transport to take them to Gibraltar and being brought back to the UK. These five or so very enterprising soldiers who'd made it to the embassy, ironically, they couldn't be repatriated because their release from a camp had not been, they'd not been in a camp.
Yeah.
So they had to be smuggled into the group that were being officially repatriated. They couldn't leave. Once they were in the British Embassy, they couldn't leave it. By the sound of Ray's account, he makes it sound like they lived the life of Riley in the embassy because obviously they were eating very well. These are lads who hadn't eaten for days and weeks, in some cases eaten properly, and they were getting the embassy food. So they had a little spell of about a month, kind of from their point of view, living in the lap of luxury, but they couldn't go out.
Right.
In fact, he had to run. He got a taxi with an embassy official accompanying him to the embassy in Madrid. But the embassy official had to go in the front door, and he told Ray to just simply run round the back because the embassy was guarded by Spanish police. In fact, Spanish police were off duty when they turned up, so Ray could go in through the front door. But that, so he could have been snatched at the very last moment. And in fact, when he was on the train from Barcelona to Madrid, he could have been arrested. But luckily, you carry on.
So how does he get from Madrid to Gibraltar then? How does he make that final leg?
Right. So what happens there is that the young men who've been released from the concentration camps by negotiation by British diplomats, they are brought to the embassy to spend one night before they are taken by bus to Gibraltar.
Okay. So it's a bus.
So,
right.
So this small number that are present in the embassy simply join that group, and their papers presumably aren't checked. This isn't covered in the story. But because there are like 20 others now have arrived from the camp, they simply add this group who are stuck in the embassy to them, and that's how he gets on board the boat up at Gibraltar.
So what's his, I mean, does he write about what, you know, because I am sitting in a studio that is, this is less than 30 kilometres from the Rock. So,
right.
Yeah.
You were on the coast, north coast somewhere.
Southern coast of Spain. So, and it drove down this morning. You could see it, you know, and you could see it sparkling. So what's his, does he write about what it's like to see Gibraltar? I mean, you know, because many of us will be having a wry smile about seeing Gibraltar and being full of hope. But does he write about seeing Gib himself?
Yeah, I mean, he does write about his feelings. He's a 19-year-old boy, so he didn't tell as much of his feelings, but he does talk about his feelings. His greatest hope is when he's going to Marseille, because he thinks that once he gets to Marseille, it's a port town, city, he will very easily be able to find a passage back to the UK, which, of course, he's completely wrong about that. So when he's walking through the mountains north of Marseille, he's confident of getting there. And he's, at that point, his account reads like a kind of holiday journal. He's saying, oh, the villages and the chateau are absolutely beautiful, the sun's shining. And that's, you know, that's what he's saying when he's there. By the time he gets to Spain, really, he's not disabused of all hope because he's a very optimistic young man.
Yeah, he's got the thing of youth. He's 19 years old, you know?
Yeah, exactly right. But the walk to Barcelona, he's alone. He has no access to food. Mm. He's completely exhausted. So he doesn't have much time to talk about that. But when he gets to Madrid and subsequently to Gibraltar, he has a little, for about a week, they're waiting for a ship from Gibraltar that can accommodate them. So the small group who've been brought over from who've been brought over from Spain, they are each given to a British regiment, which is sitting in Gibraltar waiting to be used. But they don't have to, they're not required to do anything military. So he actually gets something like a week's holiday on Gib while he's there. So he does write very, very positively about being able to go sightseeing, as you can imagine, in Gibraltar. So you're right about his youth, right? So he just takes all this in his stride. So, you know, when he's with the family in the village in northern France, he just joins in with the family affairs, plays with their kids and so on, as though there isn't a war going on. Yeah. So do you know what I mean? So he has that, which we'll all remember. You probably remember, I'm sure you remember it yourself, but that adaptability of youth.
What happens? I mean, he gets home. I mean, he gets back to the UK. Do you know what happened to his life? I mean, how was the rest
of
his...
I do know what happened to him. I do know what happened to him later in the war. And I don't... Although... So it's non-fiction, the book, obviously. It's a true story. But I don't... I'm not giving away what happens subsequently because I think... people need to read the book, because obviously I had to write the end of the book because Ray ends his account when he gets back to the UK, back to his mum and dad in Luton, or Dunstable to be precise. He worked in Luton, but Dunstable. So give Dunstable its part in the story as well. And he happens to arrive in Christmas week.
That's the Hollywood ending, isn't it? Basically, you know, exactly. There's a knock on the door at the Dunstable. You know,
and I was just about to say the same thing. So, if there's any film producers listening, that is your ending right there. So he comes back in Christmas week, and then by the New Year, he gets some 2 weeks privileged leave to recognise his escape. So he's 2 weeks at home over Christmas, and then he's sent back to his regiment, who at this point are in Kent on coastal defence duties. And so I pick up the story from there. It's difficult. It was quite difficult. I did quite a lot of research. So the story does carry on after Ray gets back, after his own memoir ends. It carries on. It's got two short chapters where I explain to what happened to him afterwards.
Fascinating stuff. I could talk to you about this until probably Wednesday, but I'm about to run out of time.
Well, buy the book.
Exactly. So, listeners, go to the TRE website and you'll see a picture of the front cover, The Longest Walk Home. Great front cover. The book is by David Wilkins. So you go and click on that, and then a well-known distribution service will be winging its way to you. David, can people find you online?
I don't do that. I don't do online presence. I'm old, so I can't be found online. But I hope. People can buy the book online.
Buy the book from the TRE website. The book is called The Longest Walk Home. It was written by Ray Bailey, put together by David, edited by David Wilkins. David, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
And you, Giles. Thank you very much.